The House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development will come to order. And we're short Representative Lindsay. He is ill, so he will be excused for today. And we'll get started on the, I'll open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2315. Zach.
House Bill 2315 decreases transit fees for elderly and disabled persons during certain hours of the day.
And we're joined by Representative Greenlick, if he would like to come up and tell us about the bill. Apologize for the delay in getting started. My colleagues are apparently still at lunch, at least some of them.
I understand the problem. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, for hearing this bill today. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, which is Northwest Portland all the way to North Plains, and basically almost entirely within the bounds of TriMet in the Portland metropolitan area. This bill is a relatively simple bill, but doesn't even necessarily get where I want to go. And I've been back before this committee on several occasions trying to move where I want to go. Currently, transportation districts need to make available transportation to elderly people that's at about 50% of the regular fare, except during rush hours. This bill would move that to 35% of the regular fare when for a person over 65 or a disabled person, if that district receives funds from the Elderly and Disabled Special Transportation Fund. Where I really want to go is to move to encourage people in the TriMet area, poor elderly people or elderly people generally, to move off the special use of the ride and onto fixed route transportation. And I hear from my elderly respondents, some of whom are who are disabled and some of whom are on SSI, that cost is a barrier. I think it costs now, for example, $1.85 or something to take the to call the ride, and it costs something like $1 to use fixed route transit. I understand the Eugene Transit District has over time moved entirely to free transportation, not during the rush hours, to people who are over 65. What I would like to have happen eventually, and this is a step in that direction, and I'd be happy to amend it and make it go all the way along, I would like the elderly folks who are receiving SSI, which is probably in the state about 3% of the elderly population, to have totally free transportation on fixed route transit, so that they would have they could call the ride out for $1.85, but could get on bus 15 and get to where they need to go free, not during the rush hour. It seems to me a completely reasonable approach. TriMet keeps talking to me about a cockamamie survey they do of general ridership who say price isn't the barrier. They would like better bus stops and more frequent schedules. But those surveys aren't really with the population that's at issue here. And the population that's at issue here, in my mind, is the elderly and disabled, and particularly the elderly who are poor. So I would ask you to move this bill. If you think there's a possibility that you'd be interested in an amendment that would take it one step further and make free transportation in non-rush hours for elderly who are on SSI, about 3% of the elderly population in Portland, I would really love the opportunity to submit that that amendment to this bill.
Thank you, Representative. Are there questions? I have a couple of. I pulled the statutes and then pulled the budgets. I tried to go back and find how much money was actually put into the transportation fund. Do you know offhand how
much? I don't.
That was kind of a I went back and looked at how money made its way in from the cigarette tax and also from the ID cards, and I thought it didn't look like there would be a great deal of money there, but I couldn't find the budget.
I've not calculated. I'll be happy to find that calculation, make some estimates on what it would be. What I do know is the ride, the special, that's the special population transportation system in Portland costs something between $10 and $20 a trip. I think probably closer to the $20, although you have a TriMet speaker coming up, and he can probably tell you that. And it seemed to me it wouldn't take diverting some of those special and very expensive rides onto fixed routes would, I think, ultimately, partially or maybe totally, cover the expense of losing whatever fares the TriMet now gets for the over 65 population.
Is there any? We don't have a. Is that correct, Zach? We don't have a fiscal on this.
Yes, sir.
The amount that this would actually be used would be of great interest, but we don't probably have that at this point either. Or,
no, and I don't think TriMet's been asked for the fiscal on this. But if we do ask for fiscal on this, I'd also love to ask for a fiscal on an amendment that would essentially provide free transit as the Eugene district. I think Springfield is well to it, as I understand. Or maybe that's part of the same district.
Please.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I appreciate it. Springfield does have a free program for people over a certain age, and we just got some testimony that says that they've been experimenting with a program to offer free passes to people over 65, but they've also been cutting routes and services in the district, and people have been, the senior and disabled people that they've been communicating with are saying we'd rather have more service rather than free rides. So it's a real tricky issue out there in providing rides for anyone. So anyone who is on taking one of the dial-a-ride services has to pay the traditional fare that they would pay on a fixed route, which I think it's I think it's probably significantly more than $20 for the fixed route. Yeah. I mean, for the special needs ride. And I know that in my district, about on that particular service, they lose at least, $3 million a year that they, are not reimbursed for the rides. And TriMet is about 10 times that size. So you can multiply everything from my district by 10 for TriMet. So we just don't have enough money to provide these rides for anybody. And I know that most of the transit districts that are out there are trying to do everything they can to move people off of the dial rides onto the fixed rides. So it'll be interesting to hear what TriMet has to say about the costs issue.
Well, Mr. Chair,
please,
Representative Beyer, it seems to me it wouldn't be too hard to calculate how much of the movement to the fixed ride would pay for making fares free now for that very small population, but also the one that's most likely to need the ride to get to get places. And the irony is, one of the main places they need to get to is medical care, and we as a state and a country provide these dual eligibles, the people on SSI, with free medical care, but we charge them to get on a bus to go to the doctor. I mean, it really does sound, there's a sort of irony about this that amuses me.
Mr. Chair, just quickly.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
I've been working on the issue of trying to get dollars into transit, and especially special needs transit, for a long time, so I always have to look real close at bills that I think might have an impact on the limited amount of dollars that we have going into these districts. And I'm not sure if this bill, if it says if they have a mass transit district, whether that would be, is in your mind, is the definition the bigger districts like LTD or TriMet or Chariots? Because we have a lot of smaller transit districts out there that, you know, it's very difficult for them to provide rides. So that's a question that I have about who this would cover.
I think that's defined under the under statute 267.010, and I don't have that at my fingertip. But I think it's designed for the large districts rather than for specific smaller. And I would certainly be willing to
make sure.
Direct it directly at TriMet, which is what's my interest. I mean, we regulate them, we help them provide, increase their taxes because they, their business tax, because they say they need help, and we work with them, but they don't seem to take guidance from us on these kinds of issues, and I would hope to provide a little more guidance on it.
Other questions? See none. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for hearing us.
And we have Aaron Dees from TriMet signed up.
Happy Friday. co-chairs, actually Reason here, co-chair Benz, and co-chair Beyer, and co-chair Sheehan. My name is Aaron Dees, and I'm with TriMet's Office of Government Affairs. And I appreciate the opportunity to discuss 2315. It's a topic area that I talk about all the time, so it's a personal interest. And I also like to express my appreciation for Representative Greenlick. He's the former chair of the Choo Choo Caucus. He's been a strong friend of transit, and we appreciate everything he's done for commuter rail. We just want to say that we admire his willingness to push hard as it takes to make positive change happen. TriMet strongly supports improved service for seniors and people with disabilities. It's an important part of our mission. as members of the committee are aware, the baby boom is approaching retirement. In 2007, the legislature commissioned a PSU study to look at the future of demographic changes and how it would affect transit in this state. What they saw was a baby boom tsunami that is going to dramatically affect all transit providers. In the next 25 years, Portland metro area expects population to grow by about, of this population to grow by more than 150%. Nationally, nearly 10,000 people will be reaching 65 every day for the next 19 years. Significant. For TriMet, these demographic changes are extremely challenging. Today, TriMet provides about 100 million rides per year. 10 million of these are for seniors and people with disabilities on our fixed route, and we provide about 1 million rides on our Lyft paratransit. These rides are certainly going to grow as population grows. Each year, TriMet spends over $30 million in these Americans with Disabilities Act mandated rides, of which 80% of this funding comes directly from our general fund. So what's the problem that that House Bill 2315 is trying to address? I think Mr. Representative Greenlick said exactly. It's how to get more seniors and folks with disabilities to ride the fixed route and not have to provide the expensive paratransit rides. We agree that helping seniors and folks with disabilities use transit is important, especially these demographic changes. We just disagree on what that affordability is the barrier. There are two things. One, in our cockamamie surveys that Representative Greenlick refers to, we do them every year to sort of assess what people think of TriMet. These are riders, non-riders, they call the Attitudes and Awareness Survey. 88% of riders 65 and older think that the TriMet ticket value is a good value, and respondents that were 65 or older were more likely than any other age group to rate the value as excellent. Only 5% rate the value as poor. Now, this isn't obviously the demographic that Representative Greenlee is trying to get to, are the very poor seniors and folks with disabilities. The second point I wanted to make was that TriMet does provide fairly deep discounts to our seniors and people with disabilities. A one-month pass for our honored citizen is $26, with the regular fare is $88, which comes to be about 29.5% of the full fare. It's also important to note that 66% of the honored citizens use these monthly passes, so significant majority use the discounted passes. The single fare tickets are about 42% of full fare. They're a dollar. And I'm sure Representative Byer can recite the following in her sleep, but transit providers need resources to help keep seniors and people with disabilities in their homes and independent. These services not only save the state money, they dramatically improve the quality of life for our fastest growing demographic. And I realize this message is not going to go very far this session, given the budget circumstances, but it's something I think our state must get a handle of in the near future. Thanks for the opportunity to discuss this subject, and I'm happy to take questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Dees. Are there questions? I have several. You said that 66% of the honored citizens, I take it honored citizens are what age? Is that
65.
And the...
And I think it includes folks with disabilities as well.
And that 65% of what number, just out of curiosity?
We provide 10 million rides per year on our transit system.
Right, but how many of those are for folks over 65?
Oh, you mean the breakdown between who? Seniors and folks with disabilities?
Yeah. Well, the seniors. How many are seniors?
That is a good question. I can get back to you on that. We put them together as honored citizens.
And I'm asking the same question. I'm just trying to get to how many people fit into the honored citizens / disability.
Oh, say not rides, but how many actual people?
Right, how many people?
I'll get back to you on that. I have it as rides in my head, because that's how that's typically how we track. So probably generally when people have passes, they're the ones that provide the bulk of the rides. But I can get you exact numbers on that.
What I was trying to ferret out is how many folks apparently aren't using this service, because that is what this bill appears to be trying to get at.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd just like to know who isn't using the service because the cost is too high. And I'm not sure exactly how you're going to figure that out. But this bill appears to be designed to solve that problem. I'd like to know how big it is. The bill is also set up so that there's the district offers the discount if the district receives money from the Elderly and Disabled Special Transportation Fund. Mm-hmm. So does TriMet receive monies from that fund, and if so, how much?
We receive about $1 million. We receive over $5 million per biennium, but we pass through most of that to the smaller transit districts in our region. For our own transit service, I think it's about $1.5 million, maybe a little bit more, that we actually keep.
Yeah. And is it in some fashion directed toward the demographic for which the fund is named?
It's entirely spent on our LIFT program. Yeah. So. It's that's part of the about $6 million that we receive in funding each year of the 31 that we spend.
And how much of the LIFT program is paid for with this fund? All of it, half of it?
Of our total $30 million budget, about $1.5 million.
But the $30 million budget is a total for the LIFT fund, is that
mm-hmm.
what you're saying?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, per year,
yeah.
Not per biennium. Also, I have to say that the percentages, I think if we did the math on the percentage that we're charging versus what this bill is suggesting, we actually, I think, are less than what this bill is suggesting. I can't verify that, but I will verify that for you.
That would be good.
Also, there's a little bit of a difficulty in and I know we ran into this when we had Fairless Square, that it's difficult for our operators to keep track of who's paying what fare at what time and when, and if they're, and I know that that's always been a little bit of a frustration. This bill would require seniors and people with disabilities to get the fare reduction during non-rush hours as defined in the bill. So if the senior gets on at rush hour, the bus operator needs to know that they charge this fare, not that fare. It starts to become a little difficult. But that's really not the point. The point is to provide less expensive rides, and what is the barrier to people riding. And I think we have done a lot of work to try to reduce reduce the number of folks that use Lyft, because obviously it's so expensive. We've set up an accessibility center down in downtown to assess every single person who rides Lyft to determine if they would be better served by fixed routes. I can go on and on and on forever about this, but it's really important that for people to know that riding Lyft is not like calling a taxi and having them show up. They have to call days ahead. It's a 2 to 3 hour window of when they get picked up, because they're picking people up along the way, and then they go and then they get picked up, and then it's a 2 to 3 hour window of opportunity when they get dropped off. It's not a convenient service, and you can't. It's usable for medical services and things like that, but it's difficult. And if we can convince folks that if we can help train them, which we do, we provide training services for seniors to help them get comfortable with riding the bus and break down some of those barriers that might not be necessarily physical barriers, but barriers of how they think about transit. So we take it very seriously, because it is a scary circumstance.
Well, thank you for that explanation. Are there questions, Mr. Dees? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And with that, we're going to close the work session on 2-3. Well, before I do, are there other folks that want to be heard on this bill?
No, we're going to close the work session.
I'm sorry, close the public hearing. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2315 and open the public hearing on House Bill 3149. Zach.
House Bill 3149 establishes standards for vehicle sharing programs. It requires personal vehicle sharing programs to provide liability insurance for times when the automobile is in use in that program. Representative Cannon will be here for that.
Representative Cannon will be here shortly. Okay, so we'll stand in recess for a few moments.
Do a work session on 2132.
We'll come back to order. So, Representative Cannon.
Great. And I'm going to bring someone else up too, if I may.
Please. And we've opened the public hearing on House Bill 3149. So
thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for your patience as I made my way from my office. For the record, my name is Ben Cannon, State Representative, House District 46. I am joined by John Atchison. Did I get that right?
Atchison.
Atchison, of a company called Get Around, and I'll let him speak in a moment. I'm here merely to introduce House Bill 3149 and then to let the experts tell you more about it. But the concept that's envisioned with this bill is a type of program that would be new to Oregonians, but not new to residents of the Bay Area, and John will have more to say about that. It is a car-sharing program, and I think the place to start for Oregonians, or at least Portlanders, is Zipcar. Some, maybe all of you, are familiar with Zipcar, which is a car rental service. But rather than a car rental service where you go to the airport or go to a car rental company to get the car, the cars are located in neighborhoods. They're in on neighborhood corners. You use a little badge. I've got one in my pocket to unlock the car and rent it on an hourly basis. And it's been a really effective way to help folks supplement their existing car or live without car a car and use Zipcar for occasional needs. This concept that John is bringing to us today and his business is implementing in California, rather than a company fleet of cars that are available for rent, uses neighborhood, family, privately owned cars that are made available to a voluntary pool of folks who sign up for hourly or daily car sharing, car rentals. And so if you imagine your neighborhood, or I'll imagine my neighborhood, and you know, my neighbors have cars, some of which are used some of the time, others which are not. You've got pickups, got trucks, got compacts, whole range of cars, many of which for much of the day, much of the week, are just sitting idle. And the notion here is to try to put some of those cars to work in a way that can supplement the income for the owner of the car. And so whereas there are a few neighbors and friends who might be willing to let me borrow their car on an occasional basis, John's program would allow me to actually join a kind of car club and sign up to rent a neighborhood car from a neighbor who's also signed up for this program on an hourly, daily basis. I'll let him describe the program to you. I want to recommend it in part for what I think it may be able to do to help Oregonians put some additional dollars into their pockets, for what it may do to help Oregonians reduce their dependence on vehicles, you know, keeping a vehicle idle overnight or over a weekend or during a week in their driveway. And I recommend this bill to you. I will point out the bill is related strictly to insurance provisions because, as you'll hear, one of the impediments to getting this type of program off the ground is insurance law. We have worked with the insurers to try to replicate a bill that was passed, I believe, unanimously and with insurers' support in California. That was the basis for the bill that we designed here. So far, we have heard that insurers are neutral on this concept. I'll be interested to hear any testimony from them today. And we are also, we've brought Dash 1s that come from a recommendation from, I believe, American Family Insurance in our meeting with them. They were not part of the California process. They had some modest amendments that they asked us to make to the bill. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to John and let him fill you in where I have been mistaken or left things out. I should say I have a lot of questions about this, so I'll listen with great interest as you ask your questions to John. It's a brand new concept for Oregon, but I think something that offers a lot of promise.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Representative Cannon. Thank you, members of the committee. So, as Representative Cannon mentioned, I work for a company called Get Around. Get Around is
And your name?
Oh, John Atchison.
Thank you.
And Get Around is a startup company, a very young company, based out of San Francisco. And I want to focus on kind of the mechanics of car sharing from a business standpoint and what the economic opportunity is behind this. Just a little bit of my background. I've spent about 25 years now at kind of the merger of technology and new consumer services. I had the good fortune of spending a good part of the 90s down in Silicon Valley side by side with legendary venture capitalist John Doerr as he made the initial investments in Netscape, Amazon, and Google. Went on to work at a company called Real Networks to help introduce audio and video to the web, which people thought was a crazy idea at that time. And to me, peer-to-peer car sharing or personal car sharing, personal vehicle sharing is addressed in this bill, is, I think, the biggest opportunity of all of those. I think this is enormous. I think it transformed the way that we in America interface with cars and deal with cars. So let me actually start by just describing a little bit about the business mechanics of this. Our job at GetAround is to really create a marketplace for these transactions to take place. And we recruit car owners and renters to come into this marketplace. The incentive for them to do so is based really on kind of two underlying facts about car ownership. And the first is that the average car in America sits idle 92% of the time, which is kind of a shocking number. So basically 22 out of every 24 hours a car is just sitting in a driveway or a parking lot. And that is a pretty amazing number given how expensive car ownership is, that even if you don't drive a car at all, it costs about $6,000 a year just to have it, based on depreciation, insurance payments, licensing fees, things like that. So at GetAround, we provide an opportunity for people to actually monetize that asset and begin to generate, as Representative Cannon said, hourly, daily, weekly fees for the use of that car. And, you know, studies have shown that the average driver who participates in a car sharing program, just by not owning their own car but renting a car instead, saves an average about $1,800 per year. Within our program, the car owner now also can make significant money by renting out their car. And in fact, a car owner that rents their car just 2 or 3 hours a day can pretty much cover all of the fixed cost of that automobile, which is, you know, an amazing opportunity. And I can tell you that in California, and we've been running now a rollout of this in the San Francisco Bay Area for about 3 months, and we have had an amazing array of cars leaping into our system. And not just, you know, 1995 pickup trucks, but we've had, you know, late model Mercedes, Audis, any car you can imagine, any type of vehicle you can imagine. We actually have a Tesla Roadster, $150,000 sports car that people have put into this pool, which is just astounding. If you give people an opportunity to actually monetize that idle asset, they will jump all over it. And I think what's fantastic for the state of Oregon from that is really twofold. One is all the money that then comes out of this, both in terms of the savings of the riders and the drivers and the money that's being earned by the owners. I mean, that's all local money. It's not going out to some car manufacturer or some insurance provider or, you know, someone else. It's all local money. And this, as an industry, can be an amazingly potent, large industry. And I think probably one of the best kind of indicators of that is just the amount of venture capital interest that's sitting behind this right now. It's an industry I know very, very well. We at GetAround actually are backed by a firm called Redpoint, which is one of the biggest venture capital firms in Silicon Valley. They've backed Netflix, TiVo, HomeAway, a bunch of other companies. Money is starting to flow into this because it's viewed as a tremendous growth opportunity. And California, I believe, recognized that about 9 months ago or so, passed Assembly Bill 1871. I think it was the only unanimous passage of any bill they had all last year. And on the basis of that bill, in clarifying the insurance issues around peer-to-peer personal vehicle sharing, it really just opened this market up. And so now my company GetAround has jumped in, a company called Relay Rides. I mean, there are several companies that have jumped in this area. And we would love to come and operate in Portland. Love, love, love it. I mean, Oregon is just an ideal marketplace for this kind of thing. And to be able to take car sharing out of just dense urban areas and take it to any place in the state is, I think, just an incredibly powerful opportunity. So I welcome any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Atchison. Are there questions? Geez, well, I have several.
Yes.
Have your studies in California shown that there are more cars than on the road as a result of the arrangement than would otherwise be the case? Or is it assumed that the person who rents the car would have been on the road in any event just using a rental car or some other device?
There are actually a number of studies that show that car sharing in general dramatically reduces the amount of road congestion and use of cars, that the average person who switches from having their own car and driving that car regularly to participating in a car sharing program as a driver reduces their driving by about 40% just because you've now made driving a marginal cost. And so instead of taking 3 trips to the store, you think, oh, well, gosh, I could just do that in 1 trip in the afternoon. I just lost my train of thought. But the
it reduces congestion.
Yeah, it reduces congestion because the average car that's actually in a fleet for car sharing has also been found to reduce the number of cars overall by as many as about 10 or 15 cars.
The legal relationship between the person who doesn't own the car and ends up using it is that of what? Someone leasing the car, renting the car? What's the relationship between the person who doesn't have a car and uses someone else's?
Well, the relationships really are directly with companies such as mine, with GetAround, that an owner essentially contracts their car into our fleet. by signing up, by going through certain insurance-related hurdles, that the car has to be a certain age, it has to be under a certain mileage, the car qualifies. They then put that car into the pool. Likewise, a driver signs up and says, I want to be part of this car-sharing marketplace, and we run a driver's check on them to make sure that they meet various insurance requirements, and they become part of that pool. And all of the transactions are not between the driver and the owner, but between the driver and us and the owner and us. So we are the intermediary in all of those transactions.
But the intermediary in the sense that you are renting the car from the owner and then subletting it to the driver, or what are you facilitating the rental arrangement between the two? I'm just curious, as a lawyer, if I was getting ready to sue somebody, how would you plead the case?
Well, all of the interactions are really happening directly between the owners, renters, and the owners and us, and the renters and us. The owners and the renters never directly kind of make a contractual arrangement.
And is the legal impediment then just the insurance here in Oregon? If this bill were to pass, would you then have a green light to go, or is there something else that needs to be done first?
Well, there's certainly the practical side of just clearing the way for insurance doesn't necessarily mean that you will get insurance. And I think one of the big challenges that all personal vehicle sharing programs in California had is as soon as Assembly Bill 1871 passed, it was very difficult to find carriers who would jump in and take this just because it's a completely new thing and they had no idea what risk they were taking on. And so we had to work diligently for many months to actually get a carrier, and we're very happy we were able to get a Fortune 500 carrier to come in and give us coverage. But without the elements that are in the House Bill 3149, it's very hard to get a program like this going. And the major impediment is that if a car owner participates in this program, then they are under current law deemed to be using their car for commercial purposes, and therefore their personal insurance carrier can drop them. And that just scares everyone away. No one wants to participate in a program like that if that's going to happen. And so as soon as Assembly Bill 1871 got passed in California, it was absolutely a green light for us to come through, and the same is true in Oregon if House Bill 3149 passes.
Have you conversations then at this point with the insurance groups here in the state, and if so, how are they going?
Well, actually, we would not need to directly have that conversation because we have a nationwide carrier. So as soon as everything opens up in the state of Oregon, we are ready to go. We can hit the street running.
Can you share with us what it costs to rent the car? Is there a number? Does it vary car to car? For example, a $150,000 car is $10 an hour, I assume, or something like that.
$8.95.
What is the normal amount?
Well, within our system, the driver or the owner of the car actually gets to set their own rate for what they want that car to be in the marketplace for. But there is a general standard that's developed already, and if you have a Scion or a Corolla or something like that, it'll probably go on the system for anywhere from $5 to $8 an hour, somewhere in there. We actually have a car as low as $3 an hour. And then at the other end of that spectrum, you have things like the Tesla, which right now goes for about $50 an hour. But most cars average around $5 to $7, somewhere in there.
Question, Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have a website address or something I can take a look at your company?
Absolutely, yes. Just getaround.com.
Getaround.com.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
So someone doesn't get the car back in time. What happens?
Two things happen in that case. The first is we have fines in the system that if you don't return the car on time, you get $30 an hour fine for being late. But probably, frankly, more importantly is you get a really bad feedback rating. and just like eBay with its feedback system, the feedback system in a personal vehicle car sharing program is critical to anyone's ability to rent or to have their car rented. And so people compete actively to get the best possible feedback. And we have, renters who are, dusting the dashboards and putting extra gas in the car, doing everything they can to get the owner of that car to think they're great and put a great feedback rating in the system.
Yeah. Very interesting. Yes, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've heard a lot about wouldn't a program like this be really cool? So it's a really neat idea, but I'm trying to focus on the specifics of what the bill does. And in one of the letters we have from the Office of Mayor Sam Adams, City of Portland, it says in a very succinct way, quote, reduce barriers to a peer-to-peer program by prohibiting insurers from being able to classify or reclassify a personal vehicle as a commercial vehicle due to participation in a car share program, end quote. If I were to start loaning my car on my own, letting neighbors borrow it or friends, and I don't know how, but for some reason or another, my insurance company found out that my car was being driven more miles by a lot of people unrelated to me or my immediate family, is there something they can do to me right now? Are they going to increase my rate?
Have you been loaning your car out?
No, I haven't, as a matter of fact.
Well, too much stuff in it.
I have to clean it out.
I mean, I think what it's referring to is an actual transaction of some kind taking place. I think the fact that what you're describing sounds like a non-monetary transaction where you're just handing the keys to a friend or someone you trust and they borrow that car, which I don't believe falls under that guideline. It does, however, put you under a good deal of liability. Where, you know, I mean, we actually have quite a bit of feedback from our users that they want to be able to create kind of separate classes of renters out there so that they have kind of a general renter who comes in at $8 an hour, and then they have, you know, Mary down the street who gets the car for $1.50 an hour because she's a friend and they want them to have a special rate. But the advantage to the owner is that that car is then protected under the insurance program. It's got roadside assistance. It's a completely safe transaction.
Follow up?
Please.
So the issue isn't so much the concern about how many people are driving it, how often, and whether there's a monetary transaction. It's really the liability issue that drives it.
That's certainly, I think, the primary driver for owners to be participating in the program. I think, you know, to some extent, it's also the transaction capabilities that they don't have to go collect money from people, that we take care of all of that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, so in the 3 months that you've been doing this in San Francisco, I've got to imagine, I mean, when you have a fleet and you've got one company managing it and you've got wear and tear and you've got problems, you've got people smoking in cars when they said they wouldn't, can you describe kind of how many of those sort of things have come up, and is that something that becomes like a civil action against an individual, or do you have a mechanism in place to deal with that?
No, I mean, you know, I'm sure that we're going to come up with, you know, all kinds of things that we never could have possibly imagined, right? I mean, someone, you know, carrying an armadillo on the back seat, there are all kinds of things that are going to pop up. But so far, we've had surprisingly few issues come up. In fact, the only issue I can think of right now that's happened is that someone had a kind of BMW sports car they had in the system, and it was a stick shift, and someone who didn't really know how to drive a stick shift very well took it and kind of burned the clutch down some. And in that case, we decided to just step in, and we actually gave that person some money to help defray the cost of replacing that clutch. And what came out of that, frankly, was a very bad rating for that renter in the system. And essentially warning anybody else. And I think in all the rentals we've had, that's the only issue we've had come in so far. You know, as I mentioned, what we've seen more than not, in fact, in almost every case, is renters bending over backwards to try to make, in fact, owners and renters both bending over backwards to try to make the experience the best it can possibly be, mostly because they want the good feedback in the system. People really rely on a good feedback rating.
Please. How many cars do you have in the system right now? And forgive me if you've already said that.
Right now we have, well, signed up in the Bay Area, we have over 1,000 participants, and we've activated about 100 cars right now. And that's growing very rapidly.
President Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the question I have, and it's probably not answerable because it might be too early into your program, but turnover, I mean, the number of people who have entered the program and then chose that maybe this wasn't really the best option for them, and I'm talking more probably on the renter side, or the person who, the owner of the car vehicle, as opposed to the other one.
You know, we don't. I mean, it is pretty rare to have that kind of data. We haven't really seen any turnover at this point. I mean, the only car I can think of, there are only two instances where people have taken a car out of the system. In both instances, that was because they sold the car. I don't know of anybody yet who's pulled out of the service because they didn't want to be part of it anymore.
Okay. Any more
Please.
Question? Thank you. I understand that the benefit to, you know, if you have a car that's just sitting around and being able to earn some money off of it, but the ability to, I mean, because there's wear and tear on cars and a devaluation of a car, and do you think that the rental price is built into that is actually adequate for a person who chooses to do that to cover those kind of losses?
Well, I guess in short I would say yes, but remember our approach is to have an open marketplace. So, I mean, the owners really set those prices, and to the extent that the prices don't reflect that adequately now, we expect the prices will adjust. But I think, you know, looking at a more traditional fleet-based service like Zipcar and how our prices compare to that, you know, we tend to underprice Zipcar by a few dollars an hour, or owners, I should say, tend to price their cars a little under. And given that the incremental cost of having a car in the fleet is so small for us, and for that owner, it's virtually free for the owner to put the car and list it, and they've already sunk the cost in the car, you know, I suspect that that more than adequately covers any wear and tear that's coming out of the program.
Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of a silly technical question. Why is a Facebook account required to use GetAround?
You wouldn't imagine how many owners or people ask us that question. So that was really just a logistical thing for us. It actually helps us build a profile very, very quickly when someone comes in with Facebook. But we're actively looking at alternative logins. I mean, we don't want to just create our own login system because that's cumbersome for people. They have to re-enter a bunch of information they've done other places. So Facebook was super quick and easy, so we just took it. But we also are looking at Twitter accounts. We're looking at, you know, Google accounts, various other login mechanisms that people could use to get in the system very quickly, and we get kind of key information with one click.
Okay. Chair Paul?
Sure.
Is there any technology that you're using there outside of the profile information? Like, is that helping with tracking the vehicles, or I'm just trying to understand what the...
There's actually quite a bit of technology at play. I mean, there's a low-tech version of this that we... you know, that we support, which we just call key swaps. And when someone first signs up their car, if they just want to rent that car right away, they can actually sign the car up, and an hour later they can have someone rent it. But they're going to have to meet someone and hand them a key and all that. A lot of our technical development has gone into what's called the Get-Around Car Kit, which is, you know, a small device that goes in the car and actually lets the smartphone open the car, and the person can access the car and then drive the car. And that kit also has the ability to, for example, track where that car is at all times. So, you know, you as an owner, if the car, you know, if you can't find where they parked it, you can just pull it up on your iPhone and see that it's right around the corner or whatever.
Okay. One more follow-up. you said there's a one-hour turnaround. From what happens during that
hour?
It's
more like 15 minutes, actually. I mean, it's very okay. It's very rapid.
All right. So in the 15 minutes, how do you authenticate that person as a decent driver? I assume that's part of the equation, is you have to check their driving record before I'm going to...
That's exactly right, and for us, that's a completely automated process. So, actually, as a driver, you can qualify about 90 seconds. You put your information in, and you take your driver's license, and we go out. We have electronic transfer with, I think, 47 states right now. So, and we're only really using it in California, but we have it. So, if you sign up, it just hits the DMV server, pulls down your driving record, and does an automatic screen on the requirements of our insurance provider. If you don't qualify, we send you a note, and if you do, you're in the system and you can start running right away.
Okay, thank you.
One last question.
Yes.
For this panel anyway. The device is limited to those who own their own cars. In other words, you couldn't rent a car and get it into the system. You have to own a car and then to be involved as one of these participants. Is that a correct statement?
Do you mean actually that you lease a car instead of owning it outright?
Really, I was trying to get at is maybe I want to go buy 10 cars and put them in your program. So, I mean, could I do that?
You could do that, but I don't think that's really going to get you much anywhere because, I mean, as part of this legislation, as soon as you actually are starting to make more money than it costs you to operate the car, then you do become a commercial operator, and then you don't have any kind of personal coverage you can have on that vehicle. You're reclassified. So it's not a way for someone to kind of get in the business of creating their own personal fleet of cars just to make money. It's really just directed at people who own a car, don't need it all the time, and want to be able to subsidize their car costs.
And those folks are, when they sign up for your program, they're told this. In other words, they're told you have to keep track of how much this is rented out, and do you pay attention?
We actually have to issue 1099s for anyone who gets over $600. That's right.
I'm sorry, say that again.
We have to issue 1099s to any car owner that gets over $600 a year.
Okay, so the...
We track it very closely.
The amount below that is not reported, but the amount above that is. Is that how that works? I don't know where...
Well, it's just 1099 has an exemption below $600, but as soon as someone gets to $600, by federal law, we have to actually issue them a 1099 for the income on that car.
Okay. Further questions for this panel? Seeing none. Representative, do you want to say anything before we...
Just sitting here, I think this falls into the category of why didn't I think of that as a business idea? I mean, I think this is just a really terrific entrepreneurial approach and something that I hope we're able to enable for Oregon. Thanks.
Thank you. We have three more people signed up, but one is by video. We're going to take the other two together as a panel, David Brook and Chris Hagenbaumer. Yes, I do. Delay. Can we, before you come up, we might want to, we have a representative waiting, so let me just find out. He is. She's standing by. Is Jessica standing by?
Is Jessica still standing by? On the Skype?
Close to.
Yeah. Representative Olson, let me just ask this. Do you have another hearing you have to get to, or can you wait for a few more minutes? If you have another hearing, we're going to take you out of order.
Humble servant.
We'll and then you'll be fast. Come up then, panel members.
All right. Good afternoon, committee members. My name is David Brook. I am a consultant in the car sharing world, and started the first commercial car sharing company in Portland, Oregon back in 1998 and have been involved with several other companies since then, Flexcar and later Zipcar. And as a consultant, I've worked with many large and small startups and major corporations as well. And I was a consultant to one of John's competitors, the Relay Rides Company, which did start a pilot project in Cambridge, Massachusetts last summer that got up to 50 vehicles. So there's experience from across the country on the interest in car sharing, this peer-to-peer or this personal vehicle car sharing, and the opportunities are clear. I think everyone has, other people have talked about the benefits of car sharing, and as John said, what's beautiful about this personal vehicle car sharing is it will enable the car sharing, the benefits to go to a much wider area of Portland and of Oregon. Right now, there's Portland is the main area. There are a couple of universities that have car sharing vehicles at them that are sponsored by the university. And the city of Ashland, there is a nonprofit group in Ashland called Ashland Car Share. The city of Eugene is struggling to attract a major company to come there. So what is nice about the House Bill 3149 is, first of all, it provides clarity on what is a personal vehicle car sharing transaction. So it answers the question that Representative Nathanson had about when am I loaning my car out and when is this a personal vehicle transaction. It mandates a level of coverage on the vehicle when it is being rented of 3 times the state minimum. or equal to what the vehicle owner has currently on their car. So that means we're not looking at a bunch of minimally insured cars driving around. And to speak to your point, Representative Bentz, in the event of an accident, it clearly defines which insurance company the lawyers want to speak to. And finally, as was mentioned, it protects the vehicle owner from confusion about whether this loaning their car out in this business transaction is a commercial use of the vehicle or is an allowable use under this personal vehicle statute. So I will turn it over to Chris, and then we'll take questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Hagerbaumer. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Environmental Council, and I have some personal experience in car sharing. I actually served on the oversight committee that initially put together Portland car sharing, Car Sharing Portland, which I think was actually the first commercial venture in the country. And I'm a Zipcar member. And my testimony is very repetitive of what other people have said, so I'll be very brief and just say that car sharing is really an example of a private venture that offers broad public benefits. You've already heard that people who use car sharing to get around can save hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars each year on vehicle ownership costs. And car sharing families drive demonstrably less than car owning families. So that leads to less traffic congestion, it leads to less pollution, less reliance on petroleum. I checked the web last night and saw that over the last 2 months, gasoline prices in Oregon have gone up by an average of 27 cents per gallon. So basically, this new concept of personal vehicle car sharing, to speak to what Representative Beyer talked about, our cars depreciate so rapidly. As soon as we buy them, they begin to depreciate. So this allows you as a personal car owner to actually make some money off of that car, which you weren't able to do earlier. And I really feel that when we're Oregonians are suffering through the worst recession since the Great Depression, and I really like this bill because I see it as a way to bring a new enterprise to Oregon that not only helps some people make money, but other people save money. So we really hope that you'll support House Bill 3149.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Quick, so something like this exists for private homes for vacations, right? I mean, you can sort of do like home swapping. Any lessons from that that we can learn and apply to this context?
I think the important lesson is that you've got to be able to trust the person in the transaction, and that's what the personal vehicle car sharing company does is it screens the driving record of the drivers, and it uses the rating tool so that other drivers can figure out whether this is a car they want to use or not. So I think the element of trust has been an issue. I have no idea how the insurance works when you're renting your house out. I think that's got a much longer history than this. It wasn't until basically about 9 months ago that one of the companies figured out attracted an insurance company to actually want to deal with this kind of a transaction. Before then, it was just like nobody wanted to talk about this too screwball of an idea. But it's a new insurance world out there, and people wanted to talk about it. I had major trouble when I started the car sharing Portland. I couldn't get any insurers to talk to me. They said, that's nuts. Nobody will want to do that. But, I mean, look, there's 7,000 car-sharing vehicles in North America now, and Zipcar has about 80% of them.
You know, it's really fascinating concept, and, you know, I'm sure there's some people in Ben Cannon's district for whom it's just a little too free market friendly, but
this
with
is
that,
free market.
But with that exception, it's really fantastic.
Further questions? Yes, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the one hand, I'm really fascinated and wanting to support this concept. On the other hand, when I think about, well, this is about 100 steps beyond Craigslist. know, it's a little more like a really good eBay plus PayPal, but then it's also about insurance companies, and in a way it's also about law enforcement. When I think about how there might be potential for fraudulent use, and once you start to separate the notion of an insured driver, is it an insured driver or an insured car? And who's driving these things? And the systems that have to be interconnected to check what's this person's driving record, or does this person have a suspended license, or that sort of thing. I feel just a slight bit of wonder still that that all works out okay. So can you provide any reassurance that the interplay between not only this really neat sharing concept, but also potential insurance, law enforcement liability, all that stuff, it's really fine?
That was one of the challenges in the growth of car sharing in, well, both in Europe and the United States, was getting this whole, not only the insurance thing, but as you say, the screening the driving history of the people. That is now automated so that in most states, so that a company can go online and sort of see whether a person's license has been suspended. In most cases, the insurance companies reserve the right to rescreen a person if they have reason to believe there's been a problem, but I'm not sure how often that happens. The requirements for participating in the program are fairly strict. Generally, it's no more than 2 moving violations in the past 3 years, no DUIs, no driving over 20, none of the really major infractions. You're just not going to be, you know, allowed behind the wheel of the, you know, the car sharing vehicle, whether it's a Zipcar, City Car Share in San Francisco, or, you know, any of these personal vehicle companies.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair and Representative Nathanson, I'm a very risk-averse person, so I probably would not go into this type of business venture. But if I did, I would also look at the types of technologies that are out there that can be put in cars that, you know, you can find out if a person is accelerating too fast and all that kind of stuff. And if you really were concerned, I guess I feel like it's a business decision on the part of the decision how deep they want to go into that. And that's when you made the comment about free market. That's what's so cool about this, is it could go so many different directions.
Further questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
We have two folks left to testify. Jessica Roberts is by video, so I think this is the first time we've tried this. So let's go to the video, and we'll see. There she is. If you could state your name, we'll get started.
All right. Can you hear me? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Do I need to speak louder?
A little.
All right. Thanks so much. My name is Jessica Roberts, and my address is 6337 North Albina Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97217. Is that working for everyone?
It is. Keep speaking loudly, though.
Great. Thank you so much for allowing me to testify today, and especially, we're in a new millennium, allowing me to appear by video. I imagine most people in this room, as they think about this concept, are thinking it from the point of view of an automobile owner. I'm very pleased to offer an alternate perspective today. I have never owned a car, and my family still chooses not to own a car. We can accomplish most of our travel needs through biking, busing, walking, and Amtrak. And we like to be active, so that works for 99% of our trips, but sometimes you just need a car. I would probably be appearing before you today if I owned a car, for example. Sometimes we use Zipcar, but there isn't one very close to our new house. I'd like to give a shout-out to Dave. I was one of the first car-sharing Portland members, so I have a lot of experience with that. But I'm excited about this concept because we've been trying to make it work and failing already. A lot of my neighbors own cars. They really only use them to go camping or for longer trips. They're continually offering my family that we can borrow their cars. I would like to say yes. The car is parked right outside my driveway. It would be supremely convenient. But I know that if I were to borrow their car and something happened, it would be their insurance that would take the hit. And that doesn't seem particularly fair. That's not a risk I'm comfortable with. And so we reluctantly decline these very generous offers of car loans. We've tried to purchase standalone insurance just so we can borrow our neighbor's cars, but carriers don't offer that product. They don't know what to do with me when I call them up. So that's where HB 3149 comes in. All this does is remove a barrier to what at least some people like me are already trying to do. It gives families more flexibility in pooling transportation resources. It would allow families to save that $8,000 per year, AAA says it costs to own a car, either by allowing families like mine not to own a car or by allowing families like my neighbors to make a little money back on their sunk investment. This is simple, straightforward, no cost to the state. I would love to see you pass this bill. I'm not exaggerating when I tell you I have been waiting years for a bill like this to pass, and it would make a huge difference in my life and the life of my family. So thank you so much for allowing me to testify, and especially for allowing me to testify without a car.
Thank you very much, Ms. Roberts. Are there questions? This is a great opportunity to ask somebody a question on video, so I'm surprised you didn't want up. Well, thank you very, very much, and we appreciate your testimony.
Thank you for listening.
We have one last person signed up, John Charles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Charles, Cascade Policy Institute. I wasn't actually going to testify. I'm waiting for another bill, but I'm fascinated by the whole conversation. And like Representative Smith, I'm attracted to the free market elements of the concept, particularly that owners can get into the business without years of delay. Owners can set their own rates based on the type of vehicle they have, $10 an hour, $8 an hour, $50 an hour. They can set discriminatory rates, $8 for someone there, $2 for the person down the street. So consenting adults can voluntarily engage in transactions where mutual gain is perceived, and that's allowed. It's not micromanaged by a PUC. That's an amazing thing. There's a lot of applicability to that concept elsewhere in the economy we could try that would be great, and specifically in the transportation system. Market-based feedback. If you are a bad customer, if you're a bad owner, instantly the feedback comes back and you are not likely to be rented to again. Those are wonderful concepts, and I don't want to burden this bill with broader ideas. The bill, happy to have it go forward, but if you believe the idea of better utilization of existing vehicles is a good idea, there are a series of other things you could get into, such as the fact that jitneys, which are one step a little further along, sort of shared ride, informal taxis, have by and large been outlawed by local governments for the last 80 years in this country, precisely because they're so popular. People love them as a private, unsubsidized option. They're typically outlawed because monopoly transit districts don't like the competition. Deregulation of taxi cartels. Only six companies allowed in Portland. If you want to go compete against them, sorry, it's a cartel. Try and compete against TriMet. Not going to work. It's a monopoly. So there are many other spinoffs of this, and if you want to sort of plow this field, I think it's very fertile. This is a great idea by itself. There's other little spinoffs, and I think you could serve a great purpose for the state if you took more testimony on this a little later for the broader applicability of how can you successfully, commercially use existing vehicles more often. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Charles. Questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Oh, I have one. I just had one.
I'm sorry.
I wanted to see if Representative Cannon wanted to withdraw his support from the bill.
Mr. Chair. Yes, Co-Chair Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was a good observation. And of course, I couldn't help but notice when Mr. Charles was talking about the wonderful aspects of this bill that he mentioned plowing fields. So I wonder if that maybe we need an amendment to apply it to farm implements as well. But that was not my point. I wanted to make the committee aware of an email that the co-chair and I both received from Brian Miller of Farmers Insurance, who was not able to be here but wanted to register his, I don't think support is quite the way to describe what he wrote, but he wanted to compliment Representative Cannon's office for their inclusive nature and state clearly that they had no objections or concerns about the way the bill was constructed and written. Neutrality is the right thing, but they're satisfied with the way the bill works. So I want the committee to know about that. And just compliment Representative Cannon for what appears to be a well-received bill. Thanks.
Okay, cool. Thank you, Co-Chair Reed. Further comments? The bill is not ready to move today, so with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on HB 3149 and open a public hearing on 3039. Representative Olson. Sorry for the delay. Thanks for waiting.
Well, you're welcome, Mr. Chair.
Proceed.
Are you ready?
Waiting for you.
Okay, I thought maybe Zach was going to share what this was all about.
I guess he could. Please.
House Bill 3039 requires the Oregon Department of Transportation to erect roadside memorials to honor police officers killed on the line of duty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Andy Olson. I'm state representative out of the Albany area. You're going to have a couple different documents that are sent around to you. The first one that you will receive will be this one right here that's entitled, it's a legislative note that was in the Oregon State Troopers magazine last month's issue. And it does a good job describing exactly what House Bill 3039 is all about. But I'm not going to go into great detail on this. It's pretty simple. The idea of it is, and I'll give you a little story first walking down this and then turn it over. I have with me Superintendent Chris Brown, State Police, and then also Senior Trooper Jeff Lady, too, who no longer is the president.
Past president
of Oregon State Police Officers Association. But last year, early on in the year, Jeff gave me a call on my cell phone and said that he had some concern. He had heard some word that the two memorial crosses that had been placed alongside of Interstate 5 in the Ankeny Hill Road, which is between Albany and Salem, were in jeopardy because someone had called the governor's office and was concerned about them being out there as memorial crosses and that them being on right-of-way should maybe be removed. So in the process of that, I made a phone call to someone that I knew in the governor's office, and that stopped. But in the process also of that, what it caused me to realize that we needed to do was to consider doing what California has done, Arizona has done, and a number of other states across the country, and that's to put memorial highway signs up in different areas as a result of legislative action of a memorial resolution. Now, also, you have received a picture of what the sign that we are proposing right now and that we have been working with the Department of, ODOT regarding what it would look like. And this is a 4x8. The cost that they're projecting that it would cost would be somewhere in the neighborhood between $600 to $900. And we'll kind of explain a little bit more about that as well, the means for payment on that. I happened to be the station commander at the time when Maria Mignano and Jason Haroff were killed on Interstate 5 from a 19-year-old driver who fell asleep at the wheel in the Ankeny Hill area. And I also happened to be the one who went out and had to share with folks, too. Well, thank you. Representative Smith, very kind of you. What I would like to do is just take a moment, if I might, chairs, to read this letter, which is very short, by Joe Simon, who was at that time the chief of police of Albany Police Department, because he had hired Jason Haroff just 9 months earlier. But this letter is... it sets the tone for why we're wanting to go with this. So he says, Dear Representative Olson, thank you for co-sponsoring House Bill 3039. I can think of no better tribute to the men and women of Oregon law enforcement community who have given their lives in the line of duty while protecting and serving the citizens of Oregon. As the former police chief of the Albany Police Department, I have been personally impacted by the untimely loss of a young police officer whose dedication to the law enforcement profession and enthusiasm for his job were exceptional. Officer Jason Haroff was tragically killed on September 4th, 2001, while the Oregon State Police Trooper, or along with Oregon State Police Trooper Maria Mignano. Officer Haroff's death affected me greatly, as he was not only the first officer I had lost in the line of duty, but he was the first officer that I administered the oath of office to after my appointment as chief of police. Jason loved his work and was proud to finally realize his calling to serve the citizens of Oregon as a police officer. His enthusiasm and smile were contagious. Jason brought joy every day to his job and to all those around him, reminding all of us just how fortunate we were to serve our communities as law enforcement officers. I can personally say that the memorial privately erected on I-5 at the spot where Jason and Maria lost their lives has provided me healing and comfort for those who knew and worked with them, and provides a constant reminder of their service and sacrifice. That memorial is a testament to the lives of two special people who paid the ultimate sacrifice in service to others and proclaims, "We have not forgotten you." There is no greater sacrifice than to give one's life in service to others. Such a sacrifice needs to be honored in a public way. House Bill 3039 provides the mechanism to honor law enforcement officers killed in the line of duty that ensures they will not soon be forgotten. And then he closes with just a little bit. The other portion, which I won't read, is an email from Teresa Hine. And Teresa Hine is the twin sister of Maria Mignano. So that's a key piece, too, as well, for her support. And the final thing that I just kind of want to share with you is that when I was coming back up north from Arizona through the north part of Los Angeles and traveling in Newhall, I don't know how many of you pay any attention as you travel through Newhall on I-5, but there is the one memorial officer sign that's been there since 1970. It identifies four California Highway Patrol officers that were killed in the line of duty that absolutely revolutionized our treatment of how we conduct ourselves in training for using handguns as well as approach to people. Those four members, even though it's been, 40 years ago, are still identified, and the public that might not even know who they are can see that there was something that occurred at one time there, you know, for their service. So with that, I'll just kind of close here, but I'd love to have Superintendent just share a little bit.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Chris Brown, the superintendent of your state police. I simply came to express my gratitude on behalf of the members of the organization for this committee even considering this bill. If you step off the elevator in our office, you will come face to face with 28 small brass plaques, each of which bears the name of one of our members that has been killed in the line of duty over the last many years. Just so you know, we will be adding two names to the wall at DPSST to the more than 160 names that already appear on that wall this year. Like Representative Olson, like Senior Trooper Lady, many of the names on those walls were friends of ours. One of the names on that wall is my sister. When we lose one, it leaves a hole in the family's hearts, it leaves a hole in the hearts of the organization, and it leaves a hole in the heart of the community. I know for me it's the memory of these folks that inspires me to come to work every day and keeps me as committed today as I was 30 years ago. I know that while this discussion pertains to those killed in the line of duty, I am also mindful that it extends beyond that special group of people, because there are many, many folks that survived these incidents or were part of these incidents that will carry these burdens for the rest of their lives. As the representative said, when I pass from Albany to Salem, I think of Maria and I think of Jason, But I also think of John Burright, who was catastrophically injured in that. That incident changed his life forever, the life of his family, and I won't forget him either. When I pass by Woodburn, I think of Bill, and I think of Tom, but I also keep in mind Scott, the chief, who lost a leg and will live with those scars for the rest of his life. These people are unusually visible members of their communities, and they're taken from us in the course of serving those communities. And I think it's beyond fitting that we have a means, a visible means, of just saying thank you, and we won't forget you. I would be glad to answer any questions. Otherwise, I'll turn it over to Senior Trooper Lady.
Let's hear from Senior Trooper.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Leedy. I'm an OSP senior trooper and past president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association. For me, I'll always remember July 28th of 1972. It was a Friday. I was 17 years old, and I was driving to Salem from Woodburn on Interstate 5 and noticed the traffic was slowing to stop in front of me. As I drove past the scene of the accident, I saw the blue uniform, the same one that I wear now, of a trooper that was struck by a tired driver while conducting a traffic stop. The sight of that left me with a permanent memory. I'm sure I'm the only active trooper that remembers the incident or the location or where it or when it happened. This trooper's name was Dan Nelson. I've made many traffic stops in the same area, and it always makes the hair stand up in the back of my neck when I do. Since I became a trooper in 1987, there have been 6 line-of-death duties of OSP troopers that I personally knew, and a number of local and county law enforcement officers that I personally knew have been killed in the line of duty, including the superintendent's sister. I don't wish to forget about the 22 troopers or other police officers that lost their lives in the line of duty prior to my tenure as a trooper, but I know all of the troopers I just mentioned. I work with Maria Mignano and Bill Hakem. I, along with Senior Trooper Dave Peterson, carried Maria's body from the scene. The point I'm trying to make is that my memories are strong, and their memories are strong, but the memory of the public for whom these troopers and officers died to protect fades in time. To honor our fallen troopers and officers in this manner will ensure that the memories will not fade.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. First of all, thanks a lot for coming and testifying and bringing the bill. Frankly, serving on a committee with Representative Olson and Barker and Krieger gave sort of a greater degree of respect for, let's say, when I'm pulled over for speeding and the professionalism and sometimes sternness of the pulling over officers and recognizing the danger that they have to be prepared for in even a very otherwise seemingly typical roadside stop. And I want to sort of honor that. And I think public awareness about that is pretty important and is newer for some of us than others. I do have a couple of questions. I mean, part of my reaction is, hey, man, anything we can do, it sounds all good. But I do have a couple of questions, and one is sort of roadside versus elsewhere. The first time when I saw the SMS on the bill, I was thinking it was related to roadside incidents. And my understanding after reading the bill is that it's more generally, and probably the purpose for roadside is because that's where I have the most eyeballs, right? Where, rather than in some park somewhere we have to go visit, but a lot of people will be aware of it, and that's probably a positive. So question on that. Well, why don't I... Can I ask two questions at a time? And then the other is, are we thinking, and again, maybe we don't care, maybe leave this to the Department of Transportation or somebody else, are we thinking this would be a memorial with a lot of names, or are we thinking it'd be multiple memorials at different mileposts? And it may not matter that much, but I'm curious.
No, it's Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, great questions. To answer your last question first, there has been a total of, we've gone back to 1960, and there's 14 different incidents involving deaths that we've calculated. We would not move forward with that many memorial resolutions this session. We're actually thinking 8, so it would be actually 4 specific areas, 4 different signs of different incidents. And one, for example, would be probably near the exit of where the Salem Patrol Office is located, which is about mile marker 258, the Chemeketa exit, that area. And you would have 3 members assigned there. You'd have former Superintendent Holly Holcomb, who was shot and killed in 1975, and nothing has actually ever really been developed out there on the highway. At the same time, on the same sign, you'd have Sergeant or Lieutenant Dick Shooting, who was blown up as a result of a bomb incident over in Granite years ago. And then you would also have Trooper Dan Nelson. So all three of them would be in combined, and it would be a mile distance.
Further questions?
And on the first one, on the roadside versus non-roadside, am I right about, does that have anything to do with roadside incidents, or is it merely because that's where there's a lot of eyeballs?
Could, Mr. Chair, could I just a little bit of clarification on that? Because I'll give you an example, if that's what you're thinking, roadside versus one of the other areas that we would like to identify would be, obviously, mile marker 272, which would be the Woodburn area, and that would be Captain Tennant as well as Senior Trooper Hakeem. But that occurred off of Interstate 5, but we would like to, you know, place it on I-5.
Yeah.
And another example would be over in the Chiloquin area.
Okay.
Where
exactly.
We had two troopers killed in one incident.
Yeah. That's helpful. Thanks.
Representative Byer.
Thank you, and thank you for bringing this. I'm wanting to double-check on the cost of this, and I know that it appears that ODOT will be reimbursed by, the question is who, for the cost of this, but then that money would be, so there is, at least for the first time this is done, there would be a cost to ODOT for the first one if they have to put the money they're reimbursed into the fund, continuing fund.
Yeah, great question, Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer. The mechanism that we have in place, and I'd kind of like to refer to Senior Trooper Lady a little bit about it, but the conversation that we've had with members from ODOT is that the cost sign itself would be somewhere in the neighborhood of between $600 to $900. And that's for placement, and that's also for maintenance. And that would also, I might point out to you on the second page under subsection 6 there, that needs to be amended, that would be permanent, not 3 years. So I need to come back with an amendment for this bill as well. But Chair Jeff.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, my association has made a commitment to pay for these signs, and we'll do the fundraising, and we'll pay for the, make the initial payment on these. Hopefully, once we get caught up, we won't have to make any more. But my association has always voted on this. Our state executive committee has voted on this and approved it. In areas where it would be a trooper and a police officer, let's say in Woodburn or in Albany, I don't think we're going to have any problem with them pitching in. So we're gonna handle the fundraising on this.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you so much for bringing the bill. Okay. And we can't work today because you're going to bring us an amendment.
Yes.
Is that correct? We have one last person here to testify, Tim Potter.
Chair Benz, Chair Reed, members of the committee. My name is Tim Potter. I'm the legislative coordinator for the Highway Division of ODOT. The previous speakers pretty well outlined what the bill does. I just wanted to let you know that we would actually, ODOT stands ready to act should the need ever occur. And obviously, the gentlemen have spoken already eloquently about the need and near term being signs for already past incidents. We hope they don't be needed again, but should that occur, the bill clearly outlines what our responsibility is, and I wanted to let you know that we will serve that responsibility.
Thank you, Mr. Potter. Questions for ODOT? See none. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, sir.
And with that, we will close the public hearing on 3039. And committee members, we have some work to do under work session label. We have also a public hearing to do on 3178. It's my proposal that we manage the work session right now to make sure we get that done today. And with that, I'm going to open a work session on 2501.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move House Bill 2501 be referred to the House Committee on Judiciary without recommendation.
It's been moved that House Bill 2501 be referred to the House Judiciary Committee without recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, House Bill 2501 is referred to the House Judiciary Committee. Zach, is there any reason at all to say anything about the subsequent referral to revenue?
No.
Okay. And so moved, and we will now close the work session on House Bill 2501 and open a work session on House Bill 2132.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair.
I move House Bill 2132 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
It's been moved that House Bill 2132 go to the floor on a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Okay, is there objection? Seeing none, House Bill 2132, I think I'll do the carrier after we move it,
sure.
Is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We need a carrier.
I'm willing to carry it, Mr. Chair, if you'd like.
Sure. The carrier will be Co-Chair Reed. That closed the work session on House Bill 2132 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3178. Who do we have signed up for 3178? Can you read about the bill, please?
House Bill 3178 allows local governments to propose transit benefit districts within a quarter mile of rail stations.
And we have a number of people signed up. Let's start with a panel of Tom Gehring, Chris Nelson, and Mark Landauer. Oops, together. Let's go with Tom Gehring, Chris Nelson, and John Charles. Sorry, Mr. Charles, we'll wait.
No, we're getting a report here.
Co-chairs, members of the Transportation and Economic Development Committee, my name is Tom Gehring. I reside at 2714 Northeast 50th Avenue in Portland. I represent myself, a planning consultant with 20 years experience of research and consulting in this particular area of incentive taxation and special district financing. Thank you for this opportunity to offer some testimony on behalf of this bill. This is a market-based financing mechanism designed to pay for public infrastructure supportive of transit-oriented development in new rail station areas. I would suggest that you, if you look at the bill, you can summarize this very quickly by outlining a few of the paragraphs. If you look at lines 4 through 11, if you outline those, or highlight those, 15 through 20, 15 on the second page, 15 through 27, you will get the gist of this bill, what it means. The sources of funding for transit-oriented development infrastructure are becoming more and more scarce as transit systems are expanding and the demand for transit-oriented development is increasing. What we need is a funding source that does not impact budgets of local and regional, even federal, jurisdictions. The overwhelming evidence shows that the presence of transit station raises the value of land in a vicinity of the station. The purpose of the transit benefit district is to capture the uplift in land values that are generated by these new transit lines to pay for the placemaking functions that support DOD. Listed are some of those that you see here. I'm going to skip through these slides. Starting with this slide, land values begin to increase when stations are identified as transit-oriented development. A new station is announced, the land values begin to rise, sometimes quite rapidly. And then oftentimes when it's the area around the station is upzoned to higher density, then the land values take another jump up. So, giving an example, this is the growth of land values in the stations along the metro or the expo line in Vancouver, BC. Over 10 years following the construction of this line, land values increased by 251%. That works out to an average annual growth rate of 13.4% per year. That could be represented by the blue line here. The trend growth line is the historic growth that had occurred before the station was announced. Now, I'm using the trend growth in this case to represent the Broadway Capitol Hill District in Seattle, which has just been identified several years ago as a transit station, TOD, area, and is now being developed. So what we propose is that the difference between the rapid trend growth, or the rapid growth, that's 13.4, the trend growth, 10.3, that difference is the betterment, that is the land value gain or uplift that's created by the government action, that is the presence of transit. You will see that the graph shows projections over a 15-year period of this land value growth. The bars in the upper graph show the difference between the rapid growth and the trend growth, and it is that area that is represented by the darker red that is the betterment that can be recaptured and shown in the lower graph as $154 million over a 15-year period to finance the public improvements that would support TOD. This is basically how this method works. It's a two-step method. The first is to measure annual land value uplift in a quarter-mile area surrounding the transit station. And the other one is allocating that uplift among the property owners within that transit benefit district. I won't go into detail, but I would say that it is comparable to an LID, a local improvement district. But there are some significant differences, which I think make the transit benefit district approach more fair. And first of all, the assessment is determined by the land value uplift in a TBD, not by the project cost. So whatever the gain happens to be is the budget that must be used by the local authority to plan for the improvements. The assessments are non-negotiable. It's a uniform method that is applied throughout the transit corridor. That is also a fairer approach because all the property owners in a corridor will stand to benefit from land value increases where stations are located. So if you have a uniform method of appropriating those land values, then we don't get into the problem of renegotiating every local improvement district if it were done in that fashion. The main difference is that the assessments include the land values only. Land values then represent the uplift. That is the contribution of the community to the property owners. Rather than capturing building values, which are included in a local improvement district, that is the projected building values, are always included in an LID. Well, at any rate, I wanted to just show you a couple of examples here. There are high-performing districts and there are low-performing districts. Not every district is going to have land values raised at the same rate. That 13.4 is a fairly good, strong rate. Some districts are going to be low-performing. But whatever the case may be, the amount that is capturable from that district is dependent on the rate at which these land values are increasing. Example, in the Metro or the Expo line in Vancouver, the stations include Joyce Collingwood Village, which is just on the eastern edge of the city of Vancouver. It has performed very well in terms of its land value uplifts and also the redevelopment that's occurred there. It's a very successful transit-oriented development. The same as Metrotown. Metrotown has now become one of the largest regional centers in all of Canada over a fairly short period of time. It's a high-performing station. Two stops from the Metro town is Royal Oak Station. Royal Oak Station is a residential neighborhood. It has virtually not changed. Here is an instance where a transit agent may have identified this to be a transit-oriented development, but the market simply hasn't caught up with the expectations. Therefore, it's a lower-performing district, and
Mr. Gehring, if you could wind it down.
Oh, sure. If this were a transit benefit district, the land value uplift would be low, and the capture rate, you know, would be low as well. So, I'd like to turn this over to Chris.
Hello, I'm Chris Nelson. For the record, I'm principal of Geonomics Consulting in Portland. And I would, co-chairs Bence Reed and members of the committee, like to thank you for allowing me to point out just a few important aspects of the economic development tool known as transit benefit districts. So when we think of successful economic development projects, what do they look like? Do they involve public-private partnerships with low risk and high returns, such as propelling desirable growth without tapping general funds? Do they entail encouraging development without using additional tax burden on building improvements, as we practice in enterprise zones, for example? And if infrastructure improvements are involved, are they financed in response to the market so that property owners participate when they've received benefits, such as added building capacity and land value increases? Well, I'd just like to point out that in the interest of improving fairness in public-private ventures such as this, that transit benefit districts can provide a self-financing structure where development can flourish. And how do we know this mechanism would be effective? Well, first, as Tom has pointed out, we have now volumes of evidence that land values surrounding station areas increase significantly, especially following zoning for higher density. And on an annual basis, for example, one study recently showed that Chicago's 300 station areas found they generate about $1.3 billion in land value. So it's no surprise, really, since concentrated movement around these station areas creates opportunities for new enterprises and mixed uses and infill development. And, of course, Portland has shown well when cities plan for these growth opportunities and provide the elements of attractive communities around stations, such as pedestrian access and street connectivity and feeder transit connections and other amenities, these areas will prosper with the market. And second, transit benefit districts can spur development effectively because they first have to meet this location-location test, or they won't be formed. As with conventional local improvement districts, or LIDs, the proposed station area must show adequate initial density and potential for higher and better use through established projection models we use today. So usually this requires some commercial, you know, multifamily or mixed uses versus primarily single-family residences. In low-performing districts, as Thomas pointed out, the market may take several years to increase land value substantially. But we do have the option of a pay-as-you-go method of collecting incremental land values into reserves that allows stationary improvements to be added with the market's maturity there. And then lastly, in cases where residential owner occupants can't immediately benefit from these rising land values and opportunities, cities can make rules that will allow them to defer their share of these public work improvements until sale of their home. So whether they choose to sell or develop, they'll be able to capitalize on the increased land values in the benefit district. So to sum up here, while Oregon has become internationally recognized for its transit services and station improvements, of course, these subsidies and incentives available for future station area development really can't be relied upon and will not fill this planned need. Transit-driven economic development stands out as one of Oregon's best opportunities for successful, cost-effective public-private partnerships. On a cost-benefit basis, TBDs could shine as self-financed economic development. Oregon communities need this market-responsive option as we struggle to recover economically and raise our employment levels. So this job-creating tool deserves your leadership to help rebuild Oregon's durable economy. Thank you.
Mr. Nelson, are there questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Appreciate you waiting till the end of the day. And we have another panel, Mark Landauer, Cindy Robert, Josh Balak, and John Guile. If you want to come up and join these four, that's great. We're for those that can stay, we'll stay until after 3. But if you keep it succinct, we very much appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I represent Union Pacific Railroad. I just wanted to touch real quickly on some concerns that Union Pacific has about this bill. First of all, let it be known that anytime there's innovation in any industry or field, I think it's exciting. And if things can be encouraging transit development, mass transit, and this kind of a building, we think it's great. But we have problems with this bill. A couple things, and we all agreed to be brief. The term rail station is not defined in this bill. Is it passenger rail? Is it freight rail? So we have some concerns about that. Secondly, if the property is a shared corridor, because much of what we use for passenger rail is originally just freight rail infrastructure, but if we share it with passenger rail, then does our property tax increase on that property that we just agreed to share? Third, We're concerned about the discussion about when the value of the land increases. Not everyone would say that having rail nearby increases the value of property. We don't know how much it would increase or decrease, whether you could do retail or industrial. Different uses of those lands are going to lead to different numbers of people around it, different employees around it. And we can't figure out how much this would affect us at this point until we have definitions. Once we have those, I can bring you some concept of how much money this would cost in our central assessment of taxation. But until some of these definitions are made clear, it's very hard for us to do that. So we express our concerns and hope that you will help us figure this out.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mark Landauer representing the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Our association represents approximately 900 single-service governments throughout the state of Oregon. SDAO opposes 3178. I'll be as brief as possible. It appears to us that this is duplicative and unnecessary because it's eerily similar to urban renewal. You are all familiar with urban renewal. Unlike urban renewal, however, this proposal completely lacks any transparency or accountability. The fact that the a transit benefit district could be established under this bill without any input from other overlapping taxing jurisdictions is very problematic for us. More disturbing, however, is the fact that under the bill, a transit benefit district could be established by a resolution. As you know, an ordinance can be referred to the voters by the citizens if they disagree with that ordinance. However, a resolution is not referable, and therefore, there's no recourse by the citizens under this proposal. One other point I'll make. Those who would benefit from this proposal, the local governments that could establish a transit benefit district, are conspicuously not speaking in favor of this bill. I think that that says something about their position on this bill. With that, I'll end my testimony and be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
No, thank you very much for keeping your testimony succinct. We appreciate it very much.
Chair Reed, Chair Benz, members of the committee, I'm Josh Ballack, PacWest Communications, representing Portland and Western Railroad. I have submitted testimony from the president of PNW, Ron Russ. He could not testify himself today because he's actually at an opening for a new rail crossing on the Highway 30 that is hopefully going to make that highway a little safer. Portland and Western has issues with this bill because of the lack of clarity in the definition of rail station. We worry that the preservation and sustainability of short line rail networks throughout the state could be in jeopardy. We question that this could have broad interpretation of what a rail station is and what mass transit corridor is now or in the future force our customers and business partners to stop using freight rail services to seek locations in rail networks, forcing freight movement on overburdened and under-maintained highway systems, which would also increase traffic congestion, decrease mobility, and produce higher CO2 levels. The bill creates a great deal of questions. We are open to find solutions to any possible problems, but we believe that doing so without addressing any unintended consequences to Oregon's critically important long-term transportation economic development goals it would not be a good idea. So thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mark, you mentioned two or three challenges. If there were input that were explicit in the bill, and if, was it a critique? Oh, and if it weren't a resolution so that it could be referred to voters, I think is what you said. Do you think that the special districts, do you think that your view would change, or those are just the three best or most important critiques of an overall, is just the, you know, this is not worth further consideration?
Chair Benz, Representative Smith, in an effort to be brief, knowing that the hour is late, I listed three concerns that we have. I have a list of probably another 9 or 10.
Further questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do you have something else to say?
Oh, yeah, Mr. Chair, I did. I wanted you all to know that this is Josh's first day testifying. He's never done it before, so he did a good job.
Thank you.
Thank you. We need to sing happy birthday or something.
Mr. Charles.
Something more like a hazing would have been.
Yeah, seriously, we bring them back. I got some questions.
Then we all vote no, right?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Charles, president of Cascade Policy Institute. This is my first day testifying in this session. You know, that's not as charming as the previous session. I have interest in this bill because the focus of my professional research for the last 10 years has been on this exact subject of transit-oriented developments. I've spent hundreds of hours out in the field trying to determine how they work and comparing them empirically versus what the predictions were for them. You have testimony for me. I'll just summarize by saying that in 1996, the City Council of Portland enacted 10-year property tax abatements precisely because TOD wasn't happening. In fact, it's sort of a mythical thing. TODs really, in some sense, don't exist. But if you want to do them, there is a veritable buffet of subsidies already to them, tax credits, SDC waivers, below-market land deals, all kinds of stuff. It's still not happening. One of the attachments I've given to you, I guess this is the deal killer right here, empirically, density costs money. That's the problem. That's why you have to subsidize these things. And most developers are not going to commit economic suicide and do things that are uneconomic unless the state assists them in the suicide. And so the state does have a lot of programs. We continue to put more money into these, but another attachment I gave you is from a Metro auditor over at the regional government in Portland. Twice now they've audited their TOD program, and twice they keep telling them, why is it you never measure results after you give away millions of dollars? The answer is simple. They don't want to measure results because there aren't any. So I've also attached a paper I wrote about the West Side MACs in Portland. And so which you can read at your leisure if you're having trouble sleeping at night. My general conclusion is the only type of sustainable development really is development that pays for itself. TODs never do. They're constantly seeking more subsidies. I think it'd be a good idea for you to not be the enabler of more dysfunction here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Charles. Questions? Thank you very much for keeping it brief. And with that, I'm closing the public hearing on HB 3178. Thank you all very much for your patience, and we're adjourned.